Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of Chapter 5 from the National Academy of Sports Medicine's Essentials of Personal Fitness Training. My name is Eddie Lester, and we are here to get you rolling into the PowerPoint for Chapter 5, which is named Human Movement Science. So to kind of start you off on this chapter, it does have a lot of information specifically on the science-y portion. It gets a little bit dry. But there is only about four or so questions that come from this chapter, so let's kind of get down to those and get a little bit of those specifics, and we won't go too much into detail about some of the more sciencey terms that may not be as necessary for the test. All right, so let's look on to slide two. The objectives for this chapter are to, after this presentation, the participant will be able to describe biomechanical terminology, planes of motions, axes, joint motions, muscle actions, and how they relate to the kinetic chain, describe how forces act on the human movement system, or HMS, and influence movement, provide an overview of motor behavior, and describe the importance of sensory information as it relates to movement. So let's go ahead and click over to slide three. The human movement system must be aware of its relationship to its environment, both internally and externally, gather necessary information regarding them, produce the appropriate motor response, and this ensures optimum functioning of the human movement system. So more or less, this is just talking about how the human movement system has to respond to its environment, and that response is important for survival. So let's go ahead and click over to slide four, and specifically talk about biomechanics. So biomechanics is anything that you hear that applies the principles of physics to understand the human body and human movement. That's going to be biomechanics. If you ever see physics associated with human movement, they're going to be referring to biomechanics. And specific terminology, it's important to understand the basic anatomic terminology, which allows for effective communication, not only within the fitness field, but you can also talk with doctors and understand surgical procedures and different things of that nature. So let's go ahead and get into a few of those anatomic locations by clicking over to slide five. So specifically, they're going to refer to up or superior as a position above a reference point. Inferior is going to be below a reference point. And to use those in a sentence would be like, my kneecap is inferior to my hip, or my hip is superior to my kneecap. You also have proximal and distal. So proximal refers to a position near to the center of the body. And specifically with proximal, I refer to it as more nearer to the origin of the joint. And it's typically only used to refer to appendages like arms and legs. And same thing with distal, but distal is going to be further from the center, further from the joint or body point of reference on an appendage. So an example would be, my wrist is distal to my elbow. And vice versa, my elbow is proximal to my wrist. And this is basic, just anatomical terminology. So also you have anterior and posterior. We'll start off with anterior, which is going to mean in front or to the front of the body. And then if we click over to the next slide, we have posterior, which is going to be towards the back of the body or behind. Most people use those in everyday life, so hopefully you know those. We also have medial and lateral. Medial is going to be towards the midline of the body, and lateral is going to be to the side of the body. To use those two in a sentence, medial would be like, my nose is medial to my right or to my eyes, or my ear is lateral to my nose, something like that. You also have contralateral and ipsilateral. Contralateral is going to mean the opposite side, and ipsilateral is going to mean on the same side. So to use those, you could say, my right hand is ipsilateral to my right foot, or my right hand is contralateral to my left foot, meaning opposite side of the body, that sort of thing. Those ones aren't used too much, those last two, but you know, medial, lateral, anterior, posterior, superior, inferior, those ones are commonly used in the fitness field. So let's go ahead and click over to slide seven, and it's going to go over specific planes, axes, and joint motions. This is where you're going to get into a little bit about human movement science. And specifically, they're going to first talk about planes of motion, which is, if you can imagine, like three imaginary lines that dissect the body, would be something like the planes, which we'll get on the next slide. There'll be a nice little picture of that. And they intersect at the body's center of mass, which is just above the umbilical cord, just above the belly button. And movement is said to occur more predominantly in a specific plane if it actually belongs to the plane or moves along the plane or parallel to it. Movement in a plane occurs about an axis running perpendicular to that plane, and perpendicular to that plane means, or perpendicular means like a T, like an if you were to create a T, that would be running perpendicular. The two lines of the T are running perpendicular. And anatomic position is a reference position. Let's go ahead and click over to slide 8. Planes, axes, and joint motions. Okay, so here's your three planes of motion. You have frontal, which is the first one. You have sagittal, which is the second one, and you have transverse. And specifically, I do want you guys to know a lot about this, at least because you can refer to multiplanar movement in fitness by going through different planes. So a sagittal plane is going to bisect the body into right and left halves. The frontal plane is going to bisect the body into front and back halves, and the transverse plane is going to bisect the body into upper and lower halves. So specifically looking at the sagittal plane, it would basically run through the center of your face and all the way down through your chest into your groin area, pubic region, and separate your right and left side of your body. And specifically, it's important to know that it occurs around the coronal axis, and flexion and extension occur in this plane. For instance, hip flexion and hip extension, which would be to bend at the hip or bring the hip upwards. Basically like a squat would be hip flexion and hip extension. And that would be an example of a sagittal plane movement. Then we have the frontal plane, which is going to divide the body into anterior and posterior halves. And that's why it rotates about the anterior-posterior axis. And some examples of joint motions that would occur in the frontal plane would be abduction and adduction. And those would be like lifting your arm out to the side in a lateral raise for a shoulder exercise, like shoulder abduction and shoulder adduction. And then we have the transverse plane, which is going to bisect the body into upper and lower halves, or superior and inferior halves. And it's going to rotate about the vertical axis. Imagine like a ballerina spinning in a circle, the axis would go through the top of her head as she spins around. Or like a carousel, that rotational center would be the axis of rotation. And then the internal and external rotation would be an example of joint movements, like spinal rotation or shoulder internal rotation or shoulder external rotation, which would be like also kind of in conjunction with scapular retraction or pulling the shoulders back and externally rotating or pulling the shoulders forward, which is protraction and internally rotating. But the main one would be like a rotational medicine ball pass or cable rotation. That would be a transverse plane exercise. And you can use the book to study all joint motions, which we will go over in the audiobook lecture. So, moving on to slide 9, we have more about planes, axes, and joint motions. These are just two joint motions that are common in fitness, so it is important to understand. Horizontal abduction and horizontal adduction are basically going to be like a bench press or a cable chest fly. And they basically they're rotating up in the transverse plane as the axis would go vertically through it during like a cable fly, like a standing cable fly, in which you grab the cables behind you and pull forward to meet your hands in the center in front of you, or along the midline of the body in front of you. That would be horizontal adduction, because you're bringing it towards the middle, and then horizontal abduction would be to bring away from the middle. And the way that I like to think of abduction and adduction would be to abduct would be to take away, kind of like alien abduction, they take you away, or child abduction, getting a little serious here, but then we also have adduction, a deduction, in which it brings towards the center. So let's go on and move over to slide 10. The scapular motions are a little bit different than most other joint motions, that's why it's important to point them out. Scapular retraction is going to be where you bring the shoulder blades back and pinch them behind you, like you're holding a pencil in between your shoulder blades. Scapular protraction is bringing your scapula forward, or kind of rounding your shoulders forward. Scapular depression is bringing your shoulder blades down, and then scapular elevation is like saying, I don't know, or raising your shoulders up. And the two of these that you'd want to ensure for most fitness movements is going to be scapular retraction and depression. And what that does is it kind of puts your shoulders in the proper position to do movement without pain or injury. So shoulders back and down is a common cue that I use with my clients to ensure that they're in proper posture for upper body movements. So clicking over to slide 11, muscle actions are going to be extremely important to know, as we want to understand what muscles are doing what movement at what point in each exercise. And this is the way that you're going to analyze exercises, more or less. So you have muscles produce a variety of actions known as muscle actions, or in the muscle action spectrum, to manipulate forces. All right, so take notes, highlight eccentric, isometric, and concentric. Eccentric is going to be the lengthening of a muscle. So if you were to do a barbell curl or a bicep curl, when you lower that weight down towards your feet, that's going to be an eccentric lengthening of the muscle. This is also force reduction. And the example that they give is going to be the gluteus maximus eccentrically flexes the hip. So as you lower yourself in a squat, the gluteus maximus is active, slowly letting itself lengthen. All right, then we have isometric, and isometric just basically means there's no change in muscle length. If it during a bicep curl, it would be like at the top where you hold the bicep curl for 1 second. And what they're going to say is the gluteus maximus during the pause at the bottom of a squat would isometrically stabilize the hip. And they describe it as no appreciable change in muscle length, and it's basically a stabilization mechanism, this isometric contraction. So during the squat, your core is going to isometrically stabilize your spine. Then we have concentric, which is the way that most people think muscles work, which is muscle shortening. So when you do a bicep curl, the upward phase, or when you're curling the weight up towards your shoulders or up towards the sky, that curling is going to be a concentric muscle action. And so shortening of the muscle or force production, you're overcoming a gravitational force in a free weight. And specifically, an important thing to note, which will come up on the test, is that the gluteus maximus will concentrically extend the hip. So if you were to do a donkey kick or if you were to do a glute bridge and squeeze to extend the hip or kick back, that hip extension is going to be done by the gluteus maximus. All right, moving over to slide 12, we have the functional anatomy of muscles. And so this is where I mentioned earlier that most people think that muscles only work concentrically and only in one plane of motion. But in all reality, you have to understand that muscles function in all planes of motion and through the entire muscle action spectrum, which is going to be eccentric, isometric, and concentric. And it's important to understand that the muscles work in this way, because most people think when you're going to extend your elbow, like during the lowering phase of a barbell curl, that your tricep is going to be important for extending your elbow. When actually, if you're fighting gravity and slowly lowering something, your bicep is lengthening or eccentrically lengthening to lower that weight. All right, let's move on to slide 13, muscular force. Force is going to be defined as the interaction between two entities or bodies that result in either acceleration or deceleration of an object. So pushing a paperweight across your desk is going to be an example of force. But specifically when we are talking about fitness, moving weights is where force is. So that's the reality of force in fitness. And specifically, when a muscular force is generated, the resulting movement is the rotation at the joint. So it's important to understand this term. When a force produces a rotation, it's going to be called torque. And so just to read that for you, the term for rotational force is called torque. That's going to be important to highlight and to understand for the test. So the fitness professional must gain an understanding of different kinetic chain components involved in efficiently producing force and movement. All right, so the first one that we want to talk about is going to be the length-tension relationship. So there's a lot of information on length-tension relationships, but the basic idea behind it, to kind of simplify it, is that when your muscle is at resting length, for instance, 90 degrees in a bicep curl, it's going to produce the most force. So if you're at the gym and you're only working, you know, a short range of motion, just right around that 90 degrees, you're going to be able to lift a ton of weight, or a lot of weight, as opposed to when you have the muscle fully contracted and straightened, and then you try to go from a straightened arm to a slightly bent arm, that's going to be a little bit harder, because we have this overlap of the actin and myosin filaments, which we learned in chapter 2, and Remember, actin and myosin, or the myosin heads attach to the actin to shorten the muscle. And this is what this picture is over on the right-hand side of slide 14. You have the sarcomere, which is going to be the length of the muscle. And when the muscle is at the resting length or optimal, or there's optimal myosin and actin cross bridges, you're going to have the most force being able to be produced because all of the myosin heads are going to be attached and pulling to shorten that muscle. When you lengthen the muscle too far, if you see on the right-hand side of that picture, you're going to see only a little bit of possible attachment from the myosin to the actin heads, or the red to the blue filaments on the right-hand side. And that means you won't be able to produce as much force, therefore the force drops off. And the portion on the left with the red and blue filaments is going to be, imagine if you did a bicep curl and you're completely contracted or 100% contracted, there's nowhere else for your arm to go because the myosin filaments are completely contracted, as in there's nowhere else for, or there's no further shortening that's able to happen, therefore very little force is able to be produced. So when you look down at the bottom bullet point on the length tension relationships slide, it says when a muscle is tight or shortened due to adhesions and alters the way normal movement occurs, and this is going to be called an altered length tension relationship. So let me read that one more time. When a muscle is tight or shortened due to adhesions and alters the way normal movement occurs, this is going to be called an altered length tension relationship. And an example of that would be, like a test question, would be that when the feet turn out and put the gluteus maximus in a position that generates less force, which of the following relationships would you have? And it's going to be an altered length tension relationship. So feet turn out and the gluteus maximus is in a position that generates less force. That's going to reduce the amount of force produced by the gluteus maximus, or what is called an altered length tension relationship. And that's due to tightness in the calves, because when your feet turn out, that means your calves are not lengthened enough to be able to squat correctly. Because you want to squat with the feet in a forward-facing position or straight ahead. All right, so moving over to slide 15, they go over the force velocity curve. This doesn't come up on the test, but it is kind of interesting to understand that you can move a heavy thing not very fast, but you can move something that's light extremely fast. So if you take your hand and your pencil right now and you do a bicep curl, you can move that pencil really, really fast, or you can contract that bicep really, really fast. But imagine if you put a 50-pound weight in that hand and tried to do the same muscular contraction at the same speed. You would obviously be going a lot slower. And that's what the force velocity curve is, or basically as the velocity of the contraction increases, its ability to produce force decreases. So moving on to slide 16, a force couple relationship is going to be important to know, as all muscles work together to produce force. So when you have a simple bicep curl, to stick with that same example from before, it's not just the bicep that bends the elbow. There's other muscles in there too. Some of the muscles are stabilizing the shoulder. Some of the muscles are assisting in elbow flexion. And then you also have the opposite muscles, like the tricep, are going to have to relax in order for the bicep to do its job and bend the elbow or flex the elbow. So examples that they give of a force couple relationship would be the internal and external obliques, that when they rotate the trunk, not only is one of those muscles going to work, but they work together to rotate the trunk. Then you have the upper trapezius, lower portion of the serratus anterior, and they rotate the scapula with the lower trapezius to promote scapular upward rotation. And that's what you're going to see on the right-hand side in the picture on this slide, or slide 16. And that's going to be when you lift your arm laterally or abduct it. The shoulder blade's going to rotate upwards, and that is called what a force couple relationship is, or a upper trap, lower trap, middle trap, and serratus anterior, all pulling to help with that rotation. And another common example is during a squat, the gluteus maximus, quadriceps, and gastroc and soleus produce hip, knee, and ankle extension on the upward phase of the squat, or coming up against gravity. So just to finalize force couple relationships, all muscles work together to produce force, or all muscles working together for the production of proper movement are said to be working in proper force couple relationships. So let's look at slide 17. Slide 17, they just go over quickly muscle leverage and the length of lever arms. More or less, if you bring something close to your body and try to lift it towards the sky, it's going to be easier because the weight is close to your body and the length of that lever is short. For instance, if you were to lift your arm without your arm bent, or abduct it, lift it off to the side with kind of like a chicken wing, and lift that up, it's going to be easy. But then if you extend your arm all the way try to lift your arm, it's going to be a little bit harder because the lever arm changed and the positioning of that weight is further away. So to read this, the amount of leverage the kinetic chain has for any given movement depends on the leverage of the muscle or the length from which its rotational axis is, and in the resistance to in the relation to the resistance. So the closer the weight is to your joint, the less torque it creates and the easier it is to lift. The farther away the weight is from the joint, the more torque it creates and the harder it is to lift. Another example would be in a anterior raise of the shoulder. If you bend your elbows to do an anterior raise, kind of like an upright row, that is going to be close to your body, so it's going to be easy. And you could probably lift, 50, 60, 70 pounds. But if you extend your arm fully and try to lift that up, you're only going to be able to lift maybe 15 to 20-ish pounds. So moving on to slide 18, and talking about muscle synergies, this is kind of like a force couple relationship in the sense that muscles are recruited by the central nervous system as groups, and over time you're going to utilize the working of muscles together. For instance, during a squat, you have the quadriceps, hamstrings, and glutes working together to promote eccentric lowering and concentric raising of that squat, which is the picture on the right. And then also during the shoulder press, not only are the deltoids just working, but you also have the lower traps, the rotator cuff stabilizing, and the trapezius working in that overhead squat. So moving on to slide 19, they're going to talk about proprioception. We mentioned proprioception earlier on in other chapters, but just to repeat what it means is proprioception is the cumulative neural input from the sensory afferents to the central nervous system. Or basically it's going to be all of your senses that you sense in your immediate environment, and all of that information going to your brain and processing is going to be proprioception. For instance, I am aware that I am in a room and I'm 5 feet from the right wall. That's due to vision. And the size of the room I can tell by hearing the echo of my voice. And all of those sensory receptors are going to tell you, are going to be proprioception. And once again, when we talk about proprioceptive training, we're mainly talking about making the training unstable so that you can utilize mechanoreceptors such as muscle, tendon, ligament, and joint receptors to provide information about your current environment, whether it be static, transitional, or dynamic movement, and the sensation pertaining to muscle and joint force. So, to read off the final bullet point, a vital source of information that the nervous system uses to gather information about the environment to produce the most efficient movement. And this is basically becoming or having great coordination, or even on an elite level, having great touch in basketball to make your free throws or shots and things like that would let you know how far away you are from the rim and how hard you need to push that ball to make it in. That would be another example of proprioception. So moving on to slide 20, sensory motor integration. Sensory motor integration is just going to be the integration of your senses and then a correct motor response. So to kind of read this slide, the ability of the nervous system to gather and interpret the sensory information to anticipate, select, and execute a proper motor response. Meaning, oh, there is food here and I'm hungry. I need to bend my arm over, reach out, pick up that food, and put it to my mouth to consume. And to read the last two bullet points on this page, there has to be a perceived reason to activate muscle tissue for the reduction or stabilization of forces imposed on the body, or for the production of force to overcome.